how can we as Catholics keep sane in an insane world? How can we stay Catholic when the world and even often other members of the church work against our faith? Let's find out today on Crisis Point. Hello, I'm Eric Sammons, your host and editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Before I get started, I just want to encourage people to subscribe to the channel, to like this episode, other episodes you listen to, let people know about it. Podcast is growing, and I appreciate that. Everybody who has subscribed, just want to encourage you to do that. Also, follow us on all the social media channels at Crisis Mag. We're on all of them because we assume we'll get kicked off of at least some of them at some point. Today, we're going to talk with Matt Frad. He is the creator and host of the popular Pints with Aquinas podcast, and he is the author and co-author of several books, including Does God Exist? A Socratic Dialogue on the Five Ways of Thomas Aquinas. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thank you, Eric. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, this is going to get me in trouble, but I want to ask a little bit about your background because I asked my wife earlier, like, oh, do you have any questions I should, any ideas, questions I should ask Matt Frad? She's like, now who's that again? Mm-hmm. Which is kind of, you know, her, she doesn't really follow a lot of this stuff. So why don't we, I'm very familiar with you and I think a lot of our audience would be.
Okay, you don't have to be. I just had Father Don Calloway on my show and I actually had never heard his conversion story.
Really? Oh, wow.
So I think I was the only one in the world who didn't know much about Father Don Calloway before I had him on the show. So it's no problem. I'm from Australia originally. I grew up in a semi-Catholic family, decided I was agnostic around the age of 14 or so. When I was 17, I went to World Youth Day in Rome and there experienced a very profound conversion to Jesus Christ and came back very much on fire for the Catholic faith. I decided to serve as a missionary with a group in Canada called Net Ministries of Canada, where I ran retreats in high schools and met my wife with on Net, actually, and then moved to the States in 2005, proposed to her in 2006. Oh, well, in five, got married in 2006. Yeah, we lived in Ireland, lived in Canada. I've worked at Catholic Answers in San Diego. Long story short, I now live in Steubenville, Ohio, with my four kids and beautiful wife.
Awesome. Now, is your wife American or is she Australian?
She is American, yep.
Okay, so that's what keeps you in the country.
Indeed. People say, do you love America? I'm like, or do you miss Australia? I say, I love my family more than Australia. So
right, exactly.
Very happy to live here.
And probably after everything that happened with COVID in the past couple of years in Australia, you're probably very happy to be in Steubenville at that point.
You know, when people keep talking about freedom of speech, you know, I don't think you really know what they're talking about until freedom of speech actually disappears in certain countries. And then you go, oh, that's why the Americans are always talking about the importance of this.
Right. Right. And we kind of minimize how important it is, like you said, when we don't experience the opposite. But we also tend to minimize when we have creeping things that just kind of start to, okay, this isn't like Nazi Germany. It's just, but it's like, okay, but we don't want to get to the point where we're one step from Nazi Germany and then we have to be against it. It a lot of things have to happen to get to that point. And you know, Australia, the images down there from COVID, just are terrible. They literally had camps or something like that.
Well, my sister's getting married this year and I was told that if I go down without the jab, that I would have to quarantine. This is what they told me. How true this is, I haven't looked into it, but I'd have to quarantine for 2 weeks in a windowless hotel before being let out.
Because science.
Huh?
Because science.
Yeah, because science or something. So it is quite bizarre. You know, I mean, think about this. In Australia, it feels like all of the different news networks are singing from the same sheet of music. There's no sort of big news group that's mobilizing a significant contingent of the Australian population to sort of speak against the mainstream narrative. And so for that reason, it feels a lot more peaceful when you're there. Everyone just sort of agrees.
Right.
If anyone steps out of line, you just quickly and effectively dismiss them as crazy or something. Whereas in America, it can feel very explosive. It is, I think, at times very explosive, but because you do have these big news organizations, but they don't agree. And I would rather live here than over there, despite it feeling tumultuous.
I had a couple of months ago, I had Kennedy Hall on, who's Canadian, and he was talking, it sounds like very similar to Canada, where everybody's just kind of like, yeah, well, this is before the trucker convoy and everything. He was talking about one of his frustrations was he loved Canada. He loves being Canadian, but he was frustrated by the fact that it's like this kind of, there's this artificial peace where everybody's like, okay, we'll just go along. We'll go. There's not really any resistance to it. Whereas, yeah, we in America can sometimes complain that there's constant fighting, but in some ways fighting is a healthy sign, I would say, rather than just some artificial peace. By the way, just for people who are watching, it should be obvious we're recording on Ash Wednesday by Matt's forehead. I have not yet gone to Mass. I'm going later today, but this will be up a couple days later. But so he does. Oh, I'm trying to tell everybody, Matt doesn't just like constantly wear ashes on his forehead. It is Ash Wednesday today. Okay, let's talk. I want to talk a little bit. I want to have a conversation about the church today, the Catholic Church today, and being Catholic today, the challenges of it. And I just want to ask, you know, a few questions, you know, some questions about that and kind of your take on it, because I think we talked about this before we got on, that we're all kind of trying to figure this out together. Nobody's some great expert and knows exactly what we're supposed to do, but I think it helps us all to talk about it and try to figure out. I think we probably agree that the Catholic Church today, at least in the Western world, as we experience it, especially in America, is in a state of decline, or at least its moral standing in the world is just, I mean, gone almost completely from where it was maybe in the past. What would you say are kind of the major factors that have led to that? Why is it that, I mean, if you go on Reddit or something like that, the Catholic Church is a joke. I mean, it's a punchline. Why do you think that is that we've become, in a lot of ways, a punchline to the secular world?
Well, you know, beginning by saying, who am I? I'm just a podcaster who's trying to be a good dad and live in a state of continual repentance. And I'm not an expert or a journalist or any of these things. So take what I have to say with a grain of salt. But certainly the sex abuse scandals are a massive canard in popular culture when you discuss the Catholic Church. I also feel like there's this sort of feminization of the church, where priests and bishops and Catholic leaders have seemed for decades completely unwilling to address what needs to be addressed. There was a sort of spinelessness, and still is, that leads people to talk about being nice or other synonyms. But, you know, we're at war, we are church militants, and I'm looking for the battle cry. Not just the be a nice little citizen and get along with everybody, and what we believe doesn't really make a great deal of difference, because those who disagree with us are also going to heaven and truth does exist probably, but whatever. It's just a spineless mishmash of modernist crap that I think has made Catholicism a joke. Like, I think Islam is false and Muhammad is a false prophet, but I often think I have greater respect for the Muslims that I meet and interact with than I do for myself or many of the Catholics I interact with, because, you know, they're bloody fasting seriously, and they seem to know who they are. And so even though I think what they believe is false, I think I have more respect for them sometimes. So maybe it's we don't know who we are, and we're kind of running after mainstream society, begging them to like us. Pathetic. And maybe that's why we're viewed as pathetic.
Yeah. I think I like what you said. We don't know who we are. I mean, also, it's interesting. I have a friend, Russian Orthodox, and, you know, their liturgy can last 2.5 hours, and they're all standing the whole time. There's no pews or anything like that. This is somebody local here. And it's just like that, I mean, at the very least, when you show up there, you're like, okay, we're taking this seriously. Because you have to show up for a 2.5 hour liturgy while standing the entire time. I mean, I'm not saying it's like, you know, some type of let's show how macho we are, but I do think it's like you don't go there unless you're serious about it, that you're like, okay, I take my faith seriously. Whereas, you know, the 55 minute nice homily, cushion seats, a little bit of kneeling at a typical suburban Catholic parish, it does send a certain message. But I think you're right that we don't know who we are. And I think why people aren't attracted to organizations that don't have a sense of identity.
And that's a great point.
Yeah. I mean, why would I be like, if they don't know who they are, why would I want to join them?
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem to make any sense. And so I mean, where does this come from, though? Where did we look? Because if you look at, and I'm not one, I know people might think this, but I'm not one who idealizes the 1950s, like it's the perfect decade or something like that. But it does seem that back then, at least Catholics knew who they were. They knew they didn't eat meat on Fridays. They, you know, things like that. You know, they went to Mass every Sunday. They went to confession on Saturday night, you know, a lot. And but now we don't. Why do you think we've lost that sense of identity, even since then, but just in general?
I don't know. I wish I did. I'm not a historian. I don't know anything about history, much less the history of America. But I have to think it must have something to do. Well, again, I think all I'm going to have to... I would learn much more from you, Eric, giving me your opinion than me giving you mine. But certainly the thing that maintains our identity is tradition. And if I mock where I come from and belittle the traditions that sustained those that went before me, then it's like I have amnesia at that point. So I'm not sure what led to the severing of tradition, the despisal of tradition, but I would have to think that that plays a major part in the sort of amnesia that the modern Catholic experiences.
Because tradition really does give us our identity, our group identity, who we are. I remember I read something, it was Cardinal Dolan years ago. I don't even know if he was Cardinal of Archbishop of New York yet, but he wrote something about Catholic identity. And it really struck me. And, you know, I mean, we can all have our issues with the different cardinals and archbishops, but it was about the idea of how we've lost our identity and these identity markers. The number one identity marker is on your forehead right now, being a Catholic.
Right.
But just in general, though, like no meat Fridays. I a priest just told me recently that he found that more Catholics left the church in America after the bishops rescinded no meat Fridays than they did with the changes in the Mass. Now, I don't know how accurate that is, and I've heard similar things, but I do know, I remember talking to somebody, we were doing at our parish, this is years ago, and we were doing this come back, you know, at Easter and Christmas, we had this ad, like, come back and ask any questions you want about the church at this meeting. And I would just sit there, because this was people, Christmas and Easter Catholics who would show up. And I remember one of them, he really had a crisis of faith, because he said, if the church can change the teachings on meat Fridays, and all of a sudden it was a mortal sin the day before to eat meat on a Friday, but the day after it's okay, then it called into him a question about the entire teaching of the church. Now, we both know there's a difference between disciplinary measures and don't, but for the average Catholic in the pew, it at least came across as a complete, like almost a rejection of where we came from, of an important tradition, of an identity marker. Now, why they decided to get rid of that stuff, I think that's, I don't think I know the answer to that either, but they did get rid of it.
I mean, the one thing that's obvious as the nose on my face is the fact that young people want to be treated seriously and they want a strong horse, not a weak horse. You know, they want something that's going to make demands of them. That is so clear, it couldn't be clearer. No one wants to walk into a shapeless, spineless, a version of Christianity that has really no requirements of them except to be nice. Whatever the reason is, I don't know. But it's, I don't know. I feel like a lot of young, I mean, look at the popularity of people like Jordan Peterson, for example.
Right.
I feel like a lot of people, maybe we have spiritual formation, but we don't really have human formation. So we haven't been told to be disciplined. And why, if we're not disciplined, our life will become chaotic, for example. But I mean, there's a man who's making demands on people, and he's respected for it. And sometimes we then turn to the church for our spiritual formation, and that those demands aren't the same. And I tell you what, I mean, I think one litmus test of the fact that people want these demands, and they're flocking to it, is, you know, look at the religious orders that are exploding with numbers. You know, these aren't always infallible, of course, but look to the YouTube channels of people who are speaking, you know, about Catholic matters, or, you know, you could find these different markers. And it seems to me that the ones who are just like, whatever, you know, like, I mean, whatever, like, we can disagree and no one cares. No one's interested in that. We're desperately looking for a rudder for this rudderless ship we find ourselves in. And anyway.
And I think that, I mean, obviously one of the most, I think, at least for me, I think one of the most obvious examples is the growth of the traditional Latin mass, the popular traditional Latin mass. I don't think it's because a bunch of people are Latin scholars. They love Latin. I mean, it's kind of funny because people know I'm a big proponent of traditional Latin mass. I am awful at language. I'm awful at Latin. I couldn't tell you the first thing. My daughter is actually at Steubenville majoring in Latin, and it's just hilarious that she's clearly got it all from her mother, who is a language person, but not me. But it has nothing to do with the Latin that people are attracted to, especially young people, to the traditional Latin mass. I think what you said is there's just a sense when you walk. I mean, I say it like this: when you walk in, I just feel like I think, well, these people take this seriously. They may be wrong, but they take it seriously. Just like you said, when you walk into maybe walk into a mosque, I would guess you would think that. But when you walk into St. Suburbia, you just don't get that feeling. So what is the answer, but I know what your answer is going to be is I don't know, but like, how can we turn things around, like in a parish setting particularly, so that, because I think that's really where the weakness is that I know we like to point fingers at the Vatican, and I think there's some reason for that in our bishops, but at the parish level is where we're losing people in my mind. How can we turn it around at a parish level? Like, what's been your experience? What do you think is a way we could help turn that situation around?
Well, I think anybody who's serious about the Christian faith is probably already doing what I'm about to suggest instinctively and don't need me to tell them to do it. And that's like flock from those pansy parishes and go where you will be fed spiritually. That's what everyone's doing. I mean, that's what I did. When I was in Atlanta, I drove past 5 to 10 banal parishes to get to a Byzantine church. And I would say I'm like a refugee from a sea of these banalities, you know? And I'm banal. Like, I'm weak. I'm the coward. So the last thing I need is a liturgy and a priest and a homily that's also coward. Like, I'm in desperate need of people making demands upon me and not constantly allowing me to sort of cut corners. So I think people are doing that. And I also think one thing we're seeing after COVID lockdowns have been lifted and that people are able to work from home maybe in a way that they weren't before. And so here in Steubenville, Ohio, we're seeing multiple families, maybe as many as 20 families over the past couple of months have moved to Steubenville, Ohio. They're going to St. Pete's here, which is a traditional church here in Steubenville. And they're not only, and they're kind of banding together with other Catholics in order to live a serious Catholic community. It doesn't have to be Steubenville, it can be in multiple locations around the country where Catholics are getting together and doing life in common. And I think that's really important as well. Last night, for example, we had a Mardi Gras party here in Steubenville. I believe your son went, you said. And we probably had like 200 to 300 people jammed in this room, having drinks, having cake, celebrating. But then also talking about what we're giving up tomorrow. And the churches are packed here. And my son isn't like the weird one out. I'm asking him, what are you giving up for Lent? And he's got a list of things he's giving up because his friends that he rubs shoulders with are also giving them up. And these aren't like weird kids who don't know how to interact with other human beings. Like, it's just normal human Catholic life. And so that's what I see happening, and that's what I'm excited about. It seems to me that the sort of modern Catholic family in vanilla American society is as in much danger of being destroyed as a child lost in the woods. It's like, if you remain there, you will die. So you need to find help. You need to find support quickly. And that's what we've done in having moved here. And that's kind of our experience with other people. It's like this very joyful life.
When did you move to Steubenville?
Over a year ago.
Over a year ago. Okay.
I'm not trying to promote Steubenville. Like, it can be, just, I don't know, like, find a good, solid group of people who live almost within walking distance, hopefully, where you can just do life together.
And that's something I've talked about too in the past, is like the importance of community. And I think COVID really exposed it, that, and also gave us the opportunity, like you said, because a lot of people started working from home, they could actually live wherever they wanted to. But I think it's important because sometimes there's this idea of, we have this utopian idea community. Let's all go out to the woods and we'll build up a little city and we'll be all fine. And it typically ends up poorly. It's either like a cultish type thing or something like that. Yeah. But the organic growth of communities, and I as somebody, I lived in Steubenville many years ago. I have a lot of friends in Steubenville. I have some, you know, I went to school there years ago. I have kids there now. I think it's the reason Steubenville is a good example is because it specifically wasn't set up as like some utopia. I mean, anybody who's been to Steubenville knows it's not set up as some utopian community. What happened was, starting with Father Michael Scanlon, then just Catholics came, practicing serious Catholics came, and they started to build a community just organically, naturally. I think they're trying to do that, like it's, for example, in Ave Maria, Florida. That's a little bit less organic, but it wasn't set up as let's create a community. It's more set up as let's have a university, and then a community will build out of it. That one's a little bit different, but I think that it's a similar.
Yeah, I mean, I was in Ave last week or the week before, and there's lots of families moving in who aren't Catholic. So you're right. It's not set up like to be a little Catholic utopia, but the center of town is the church. So there's another option for us. Yeah. And yeah, we had a meth bust the street across from our house, you know, or the street over from our house. No, I shouldn't laugh about it, but I mean, this is kind of life in Steubenville. My wife jokes, you know, it's safe in Steubenville because you always hear sirens. That's funny. So yeah, it's kind of cool. Like, you know, I've been challenged by people here in Steubenville to drop that insane dichotomy between those who are interested in the liturgy and those who are interested in the poor, to blow that apart as our Blessed Lord did, and to get to know the names of the homeless in our streets and the names, not just the homeless, but those who are seriously down on their luck. Like, they're all over the place. And the fact that I don't make a conscious effort to get to know their names is shameful. And so I've repented of that, and I'm really trying to do that. So it is cool. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, and you can do this in different areas. Like, any big city typically has enough serious Catholics that you can form a community. And like, you know, I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. I think we have a great Catholic community here. Our parish, which is traditional parish as well, it's in downtown in a poor area. And like, we have sisters down there who are helping the poor are just walking to the priest or walking around. And like, we go down there, we try to help as well. I mean, one thing was a couple of years ago when the Black Lives Matter protests were going on, it kind of became famous. The Mother Superior of our order, she just went right into it, and she just was praying, and she was talking to them. She was putting up, she was spray painting her own door with like signs of like, God loves everybody and stuff. I mean, it was beautiful. I mean, it's just getting right into it. And I think that's something, like you said, it's like, she, you know, they're very traditional, but there's not some dichotomy between, okay, because she loves tradition or the traditional liturgy, all of a sudden now she doesn't help the poor. I mean, come on, no. There should be no divide there, although that's a stereotype sometimes. So I think that's a good point, is community. I think it used to be controversial, the idea of you parish shop, so to speak. I mean, I actually probably drive by 15 parishes to get to my parish, because Cincinnati being so Catholic, there's a million parishes around. But I think it's just a reality of you have to keep your sanity. You have to keep your own faith, your kids' faith, most importantly. And so you have to go to a decent parish. Now, how do you come across, at least publicly, as a kind of an upbeat and optimistic person? And, you know, that's kind of, at least that's been my, you know, guess of kind of where, you know, kind of your podcast, things like that. How do you kind of keep that, when honestly it can be very easy to get cynical? I think, at least for me, it can honestly get cynical when you see what's happening in the church, when you see just over and over again scandal and just terrible things coming out of the Vatican. Especially if you happen to be in a parish, it's not that great. How do you kind of keep a more, I don't want to say positive, because it sounds kind of new agey or something like that, but how do you
mean, like, a sanguine disposition somewhat? Is that kind of what you mean?
Yeah. Just to kind of keep going on and not get beat down, I think is probably, because I know a lot of people who are beat down. I think I feel beat down at times. Yeah. How do you not get beat down?
Well, I don't know if people still think that about me. As I'm getting older, I find myself becoming more cynical. But cynicism is a coward's way out, because cynicism is a way of giving up, really. So giving up is a cowardly thing to do when you're called to fight. And if cynicism is giving up, then cynicism is cowardly. So I don't want to ever be cynical. I don't know. It's sort of like, why, you know, I imagine if somebody said, how do you think of a secular example, how can you be so positive when there's all these terrible stories on the news of things that are going on all around the world? It's like, in a way, you just have to stop caring, at least emotionally. You have to stop investing energy emotionally into the many terrible things that are taking place all around the world, because there are people who have a right to your emotional energy under your roof and in your community. And if you're going to spend it on people in Ukraine, who we should pray for and who we should help, but if I'm going to get that emotionally invested in people I don't know, such that I'm no longer able to invest emotionally in my son and my wife and my other children, that's clearly not a good thing. So when I say don't care, I don't mean ignore your duty to people in the outside world, but I think we can all recognize that to watch 24-hour news streams of horrible things that are taking place is just a bad way to live your life. I think that's true of the world, and I also think that's true of the church. So I just stop caring. Whether I should or I shouldn't, I don't know, but it's kind of working for me, I guess. Like, I don't really care what Pope Francis said recently. I don't care. Like, I'd rather read the lives of the saints, I'd love my children, pray with my friends, do my morning and night prayer, do the things I'd say I'm going to do, repent of my selfishness towards my wife and the irritation I sometimes express towards my children, drink whiskey with my friends occasionally, I want to just do the things that will enable me to love the people I'm being called to love immediately. And again, just like I don't mean don't care about the terrible things that are taking place in the world in an abstract way, but it's like, I can't be refreshing Taylor Marshall and Church Militant and all these guys. I'm not even disparaging them. I'm just saying to live in that place, I couldn't do it without it just thoroughly taking me out, because I just become angry or self-righteous or something. And so I don't live in those places. And hopefully, I'm sure Taylor and those other fellas at Church Militant, I'm sure they'd advise you not to be continually up to date on church ecclesial politics either. Right. But that's one thing, I think, just not to keep refreshing those ecclesial political news feeds while at the same time not burying your head in the sand. Because if I'm going to evangelize people, I need to know what people who need to be evangelized are interested in. So things like Pachamama and whatever Pope Francis just said, and those things I think are necessary to talk about, because prospective converts are asking those questions. I just don't want to live there continually because it doesn't do any good for me. What do you think? What do you do?
Yeah, I think that's a good point, the balance between them, because, it's funny, here in Ohio, I don't know if you heard this story, but J.D. Vance, who's running for Senate, and I'm not endorsing him or going against him. This is just a story. He basically got in hot water because he said recently, I don't care about what's happening in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And he meant it the same way you just said it. Yeah. But of course, a politician can't say something like that. And his point was simply, as senator of Ohio, if I'm senator of Ohio, I have to care about the people of Ohio. I have to serve them. I have to try to make their lives better. My job isn't to be constantly concerned about what's happening in Ukraine, unless it's going to directly affect the people I serve. And I thought, he's actually right. He might say a little indelicately, obviously, but he is correct in his general sense. And I think, I agree. I think that's the key. And, here at Crisis, I try to have that always too, because, our very name is somewhat like pushing the narrative of you need to be in panic, you need to be in fear, stuff like that. And I hope we're not doing that, because I always tell our writers at Crisis, we have to write about what's going on. We have to address the problems. But I want in every article, we don't always succeed at this. I don't always succeed at this, but we want every article to have something in there that says, what can we do? What can we do to make our own, make this a better situation? So if people are leaving the church and we're talking about everybody leaving the church, what can I do to make sure my kids don't leave the church or whatever, make sure I make my parish a little bit better.
Well, we need to have trusted voices in the game helping us navigate the crisis, which is clearly what you're trying to do. If I came to you and said, all I do online is read Crisis Article magazines, you'd be like, okay, like what else do you do? Right. Nothing. Like, you'd be concerned about it. So, like, it's good that people are in these spaces it's just, I don't think any individual ought to be continually filling his mind or eyeballs with what's going on, because, you know, my son, I was just walking down the street with my son the other day, and he was showing me how when he tenses up his jaw, it kind of clicks. And he was just fascinated by that as we were walking along the sidewalk, and he wanted to show me. He was very interested in it. I just thought, sometimes I think my kids, the Lord wants my kids to remind me how to be human. That's a very cool thing to be interested in. Or he'll say things, he'll make a sound with his mouth and then wonder how many other human beings have made that sound before. There's got to be a number. What's the number? That's beautiful. I want to live in their world, and I want to be interested in what they're interested in. And it might seem more intelligent and responsible to always be up to date with the latest crisis in the church, but it's actually far more responsible to be interested in the little things my kids are concerned about, to condescend into their worlds and to love them in that and not to be aloof and to be detached from them because dad's reading about important things. I don't want to be like that.
Last year, I think we all come to this realization, or at least we try to, with our devices that are constantly with us. And it was last spring or so, I had been thinking, like, I'm probably spending too much time but on my devices. And I remember I can still remember, I think it was in my family room, I had my iPhone in front of me. I was, of course, thinking I need to correct someone who's wrong on the internet, because that's my job. And my six-year-old daughter came up to me and wanted to do something or something. And I basically kind of brushed her off. Because, hey, somebody's wrong on the internet. That's far more important. And it hit me. I was like, oh my gosh, this is awful. This is terrible. I mean, this is like bad parenting 101. And so I ended up getting rid of it and got a dumb phone. And I just was like, okay, I gotta. And so now, like, my social media feed's only on my computer, my work computer in my office at home. So if I'm not in my office, I can't see what Twitter says. I can't see what Facebook says because I don't want to see. When I'm outside the house, I have no idea what's going on with that. And for me, at least personally, it really did improve. And I will admit, I fell off the wagon a little bit. And I'm like, okay, I need to get back on. It's not like an immediate thing for me. It's probably like any addiction. But I do think, like, practical things like that, I do help us keep our sanity when so much is going wrong around us.
Yeah, and I did the same thing. I don't know how much you know about my kind of tech journey, but I take every August entirely off of the internet, like no keyboards, no phones.
Oh, that's right, because I tried to contact you last August, and all of a sudden I found out, like, you're not completely off-grid. I'm like, oh, okay, no problem.
Yeah, so it's like it's the price of peace. You have to act, not that I offended you, of course, but it's, you know, you have to worry. Gosh, people are trying to get a hold of me. But it's like that price of peace and being with my family that I have to be okay, people thinking I'm ignoring them so that I can delve into my kids' lives. But yeah, same thing, I got a dumb phone as well, And it's funny, you and I might be very similar temperamentally. I'm not sure because we have one desktop at my house. My wife has the password for it. So when I go home, there is actually no way of accessing the internet. So sometimes that's annoying, right? Because I want to, like, listen to something or I want to watch something, but I can't. And that's good for me because I'm like you. I found myself as I was playing with my children wondering what someone said and how I might say something back to them. And I'm like, this is no way to live.
Yeah. Right. So basically we're trying to tell everybody stop, you know, unsubscribe from our channel. No, but I think it's funny because there's a book I read last year. I can't remember the author. It was about deep work and I can't remember the guy's name, but it was very much about this idea that you have to let your brain be completely focused on something deeper than like your internet feed. So if you're whatever your job, it was a work related book, but I think it applies to life that you have to there have to be times during the day where you're completely disconnected from the world. But one of the things I thought was very helpful that he said was he talked about like the fact that you can't always get back to people. You can't always respond to everybody. And that was a very freeing thing to me because I felt obligated. I mean, I've been involved with the internet, with email and internet and everything since the 1990s. Yeah. And there's a certain there's a certain etiquette. There's somebody emails you have to email them back. And if you have to email them back within like 24 hours, even. In fact, I saw a survey. It was actually from Franciscan about telling people. And one of the things it said was like the importance of emailing people back within 24 hours. I'm like, that's awful advice. Because what happens is you become a slave then to your email, to your messaging, your direct messaging, your whatever the case may be. And you can't actually live. You can't let your brain get deeply into any subject. Instead, you're just constantly, you know, just answering people and just and things like that. And it just it. And but the problem is, for me at least, I do. Some people will think I'm rude. Some people will think I'm not.
When I got a dumb phone this past August, I even changed my number. And then I, because I realized I had given my number to every human being I had met for longer than 5 minutes over the last 10 years. And so then I got my new number, and then I got my smartphone, and I texted my new number to about 20 people who I wanted to be in touch with, and I got rid of my phone. And so talk about, I know people have been texting me and probably still do. But I don't care. Yeah, and I'm the same as you. I just don't get back to emails. I've just fully taken it. Like, I don't care. Like, I got things to do. No, I don't want to offend any individual person, you know, but if that's the cost, then I'm okay offending individual
people. You know? Because ultimately you're, it's like the idea is that, and it comes back to what we were saying about not caring about like things in the world always, there are levels, there's a hierarchy of our obligations. Our first is obviously our own spiritual health. Then after that is our family, wife and kids, whoever we're taking care of, then to our community, our parish, and then maybe it goes out and it gets weaker and weaker as you get further and further.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And so like we really have a deep obligation to our wife and kids, our spouse and our kids. We definitely have an obligation to our parish or community, but my obligation to, like, when I see a video on Twitter or something like that about some horrendous crime that happened in, let's say, Spokane, Washington, to me, it's an emotional investment that was not worth it because I can do nothing about that. But yet it got me jazzed up. And so I was like, oh, I have to. In fact, I turned off the setting in Twitter where a video automatically shows when you scroll by it. It automatically starts. Because what I found was it was during Black Lives Matter protest that I did this because I realized it's just trying to get me upset about these things that I have no control over. I'm praying for the general situation, but just getting me hyped up because of the fact that I see somebody getting beat up that shouldn't get beat up. Obviously, I don't see how that helps me any to get to spend that emotional energy on that. If it's my own kid, yeah, then I will.
Yeah, no, 100%. I don't know how many people would push back against that. If they were to do that, if they were to say, how could you not be possibly constantly thinking about what's taking place in Ukraine? They just go, okay, do you know there's sex trafficking taking place in your town? Do you care? When's the last time you thought about it? You're a horrible individual. You should be concerned about that, as well as Ukraine, as well as people who are being murdered, as well as abortion, as well as like ivory poaching in Africa. Like, okay. Like, I think we all recognize we only have a limited amount of things we can actually be emotionally invested in.
Now, how would you say is a good way for the average Catholic when they're impacted by bad things? So here's probably the best example is Pope Francis's odd campaign to shut down or at least diminish the traditional Latin Mass. Well, that's actually impacting people directly because all of a sudden they're mad. Like I have friends, there was a traditional Latin Mass was shut down in my diocese. I have friends who went there and they're not within an hour of a traditional Latin Mass. They had vocations. There's like one of them, his son was only seriously thinking about vocation because of after he started going to traditional Latin Mass, because he started getting in with the altar boys and like he started realizing this is pretty cool. And now this family was like, we're afraid our son's vocation might get harmed. His faith might get harmed because now we can't, all we have available to us within an hour, because they live out, this is out in a rural area, is some kind of weak parish. And how do they not take that anger out at the person who's the vicar of Christ, the leader of the church, and get upset? And I just wonder, I know we don't have answers to that, but just how do we deal with those type of situations when they do impact us?
Yeah, I don't know. I think that is the role. You know, none of us with our little podcasts are claiming infallibility, nor are we saying that were right about everything. And I wouldn't say that about any podcaster. And I have different beefs with different Catholic personalities online, just like everybody does, you know, including the people I'm about to mention, right? But I do think the role that people like Taylor Marshall and others play is by, like, reminding us that we're not insane. Because sometimes when, you know, tradition is being attacked like that, you look around and you're like, this is crazy, right? If the only people around you are like, I don't think so. Stop being a spaz about it. Just, like, get over it. It's times like that that people, I think, are drawn to these other commentators. Like, I knew it. I knew I wasn't insane. This is wrong. So in a way, they can kind of, I feel that way about Daily Wire. Like when I see some of the insanities taking place in our culture and no one's addressing it. Like that guy, or rather that female who now thinks she's a man on the front of New York cover magazine, you know, who had some horrible surgery done to make her somehow in some monstrous way appear like a man. Who's addressing that? And so I look at like Matt Walsh, who was addressing, I'm like, thank God, like I knew I wasn't insane, but this person articulated it for me. I don't know. So I think there's a role there for someone to kind of reassure you that you're not crazy. That's probably the first step. And then I don't know. I think it's maybe it goes back to what we said earlier. It's about, well, maybe we're just going to have to move from our, we're going to have to choose what we love. Maybe we love the idea of living on a rural farm somewhere. And we also love the idea of the Latin Mass. But again, maybe that's just not an option. Which stinks. Maybe it's not an option. But now maybe I've got to make a decision. Do I have to move away from my little rural paradise where I was teaching the kids all these great values about living on the land and killing animals and things like that, and into the city so that I can be walking distance to the Blessed Sacrament? That might be an option this person has to make, which isn't ideal.
Right.
But, you know, that's kind of what we've had to do. Like, I like the idea of living on the land, but I'm also living in, like, rundown Rust Belt Ohio, freezing cold, so that I can live alongside people who want to be saints and where we have a beautiful liturgy and some holy priests. You know?
And the whole COVID situation really made this idea of moving so important because how states dealt with it. I mean, mm-hmm. The difference between a California and a Florida, a New York and a Texas, something like that. It's just, it's astronomical and it really has a direct impact on your life. And so trying to find these places where we can. And I think that's honestly what I try to do is try, you know, the keeping people sane. Because I remember when Pope Francis first became Pope, I was working for a diocese and I kept the kind of standard line. And at first I really was like, I admit, I know some people were like immediately I thought he could be trouble or whatever. I was like, no, I was like, no. Okay, I know nothing about him. I just assume he's a continuation of Benedict and maybe JP2, maybe a little different, whatever. And then over time, obviously I started to have a creeping realization that I was wrong. And I remember when I first kind of publicly started to say, you know, I think there's problems here. I think he's not, I just would start to say, I don't think he's a good pope. I mean, that's just, I think there's been bad popes in the past. And so it's not unthinkable that there are bad popes, that there could be bad popes in the future or the present. That's not an anti-Catholic statement. That's just a statement of historical fact. And I was amazed because a number of people came to me and said, I will say some people criticize me and say, how dare you question, you know, you're not a good Catholic for saying something against the Pope publicly. But I had a lot of people just quietly say, thank you, because I was going insane. I was being gaslit. Yeah. I thought I was the one having.
And then, I think the reason people get so angry when you do say, this is not a good Pope. Like, can we just acknowledge that? Can we love him and pray for him and acknowledge he's clearly, like, I think part of the outrage we encounter is from people who feel like they're a stranger in the world, but the church had their back. Like, it felt like that for me. Like, okay, even if my parish was a little crazy, I had John Paul II, right? Or I had Pope Benedict XVI. And now it's like, who do I have? So it's like, okay, it's chaos outside, and it's chaos inside, and I can't live in chaos. So I think maybe that's part of the attacking the messenger. It's like, no, you cannot tell me it's not safe in here. Because it's not safe out there. So you're telling me I've got nowhere to go. And that's a terrifying sort of realization, a place to be in. So I understand the kind of anger people have, I think. But, yeah, it also, as you say, it's just sobering. I like what you put there. It's like, well, how is it okay that, like, we're okay to say that there are bad popes in the past? Well, today's present is someone in the future's past.
Right.
So let's just get on with the job of sanctification. We have the catechism, we have the scriptures, we have the lives of the saints, we have Lord Jesus Christ, who loves us intimately and has a plan for our lives and knows us intimately and has a vocation for us and is calling us to save souls and to save our own. And so we really don't have much time to waste. So I don't know what else to do except to keep plowing ahead.
And I also think it's necessary to be very frank about what's going on, because I think what happens is when you either gaslight or pretend it's not, or pretend everything's hunky-dory, I do think that leads people to look into things like Sedi Vacantism, look into becoming Eastern Orthodox, look at these other options that seem attractive on the surface, because they do seem to have make a certain logical consistency. But the problem is, I think they miss fundamentally at the beginning. They have a false view at the beginning, which is that we have to accept that the Pope is always this great guy, or would never say these things that our current Pope is saying. I think when we disabuse ourselves of that, we do.
What's funny is, like, I was a Catholic apologist for 3 years, at Catholic Answers, and we were continually correcting Protestants who thought that infallibility meant impeccability. And now we have a Pope who's clearly not impeccable, and it's like, shut up, don't say it. It's like, well, but I thought you, okay, right. Now we're all very, very confused.
Yeah, I always say that, like, people who, I feel like all the people who, Catholics who told me when I was looking into Catholicism as a Protestant, they always reassured me, don't worry, we don't worship the Pope. We don't think he's always right. You're allowed to disagree with him. Then all of a sudden I disagree with them, and they're like, wait a second, you're a terrible Catholic. But wait a minute, you told me I was allowed to do this before I became Catholic. Yeah, it just is, it's insane. Now, I wanted to ask you about your, Pints with Aquinas. How do you think St. Thomas Aquinas can help us today out of this mess? I love St. Thomas as well. In fact, I just had I'm reading through the Gospel of John, and I'm reading his commentary on it. And I literally do only one verse a day, because you can't do more than that when you're going through Aquinas. I mean, and like today, he had a great thing about the Samaritan woman. Jesus told her that we say, like, your religion, your worship is you don't know what you worship. The Jews do, because we do, because salvation comes from the Jews. And St. Thomas was saying how if you don't, because God is simple, then you're either wrong or right about worshiping him. And he basically was saying Catholics are right and everybody else is wrong. And it made me think that seems to contradict this idea, modern idea, that Islam worships the same God as us. Because St. Thomas Aquinas seems to be saying, and you would know more than I exactly what he's saying this, he's saying, no, because their conception of God is wrong, and it's not like they can get one little thing wrong and everything else is okay. Because God is simple, you get one thing wrong about him, you're wrong about the God you're worshiping. But anyway, that was an aside because I thought of it. But just like, where can Aquinas help us today to figure out the mess that's going on right now?
Well, I mean, Aquinas had a deep and profound union with Jesus Christ. He was a mystic. He, it said, would often, when he couldn't understand something, he would often lay his head on the tabernacle and weep. He was more concerned about his relationship with Christ and the truth of God than what he might have to say on a particular given matter, despite who was begging him to talk about it. I often think I'd like to go back in time and convince Thomas that he was wrong to stop writing the sermon. And maybe he was, I don't know. But the fact that he kind of held his tongue shortly after that experience, he loved Jesus Christ. He loved the scriptures. You can't read Thomas without running into a scripture verse almost every point he makes, every sentence he makes. People often realize and understand that he quotes Aristotle a great deal, but he quotes Augustine more than Aristotle, and he quotes the scriptures more than both of them. So he was deeply immersed in sacred scripture. That's one way. I suppose, maybe tangentially, I wrote a little book that came out last year called How to Be Happy, and it's all on what Thomas Aquinas has to say about happiness. And since we're talking about the crisis in the church and we're talking about the stresses of living in modern day life, maybe it might be worth pointing to those things. In the Summa, Aquinas talks about five remedies for sorrow. So if you, well, I'll go over these really quick, I promise.
But, oh, yeah, sure.
You know, if you're sad, he says, well, the first thing you should do is do something pleasurable, because pleasure is like the our anxiety reposing. Sort of like if you're weary, then you seek rest, sleep, right, in order to be refreshed. And if you're anxious or sad, you do something pleasurable in order to sort of regulate. I forget the exact order, but he also says we should seek the comfort of friends. Because when we share our burden with somebody else, we see their concern for us, and that gives us pleasure. And it's also like dividing the load that we're carrying, so that we should really do that. We should seek the comfort of friends. He says that we should contemplate the truth, because unlike beasts who are satisfied with copulation and food and water and rest, humans aren't. When we get those things and we're at a state of peace, we then ask questions about the fabric of reality. This is often why it's said that philosophy arose when it did, in a relative state of peace in Greece, hundreds of years, of course, before the time of Christ, the pre-Socratics, and 500 years before Christ and Socrates, you know. What else does he say? He says we should cry. He says if you're sad, he says tears and groaning. And we're upstream, I think, of a lot of weird characters of masculinity, and so we might have the erroneous idea that men ought not to cry, but our blessed Lord and Savior did, and so did Thomas. So get over yourself. Tears and groaning. And he says, he says this line that sounds like something my mum says or said when I was five. He says, because a hurtful thing hurts all the more when we keep it shut up. And he says, it's really pleasing to a man when he can act on the outside the way he feels on the inside. And so to cry, to pray for that gift of tears, to groan if we're actually sad. I don't know how many I've gone through. Is that three or four? But the last one, which people often like, is sleep and baths. If we're feeling exhausted and run down by all of this, take a hot bath and have a sleep, because we don't have bodies, we are bodies. We are our bodies. And so if our body is exhausted, we are exhausted. And so restoring the body is a way to restore the soul. I mean, it's funny that the culture hijacks what Catholics drop. Like when we drop rosary beads, people were hanging them around their window mirrors and putting them around their necks. Well, self-care, this is really what Aquinas is talking about. It's talking about taking care of our body, taking care of ourselves. Not in a selfish, sort of navel-gazing, solipsistic sort of way, but so that we can better relate to our Lord and to each other. So those might be a few interesting things. I wasn't meaning to plug the book, but if people are interested, it's on Audible, and it's also available on Amazon or whatever.
Yeah, and I'll link to it. Definitely link to it in the show notes.
It's an easy read. I'm not a scholar or an intellectual. I'm merely a studious amateur, but it's I think it's quite good. It's got good reviews and things, and so people could check that out if they want to learn more.
It seems like Aquinas, one of the things he really can give us is he's very balanced. It's like what you said about when you're sad, seek pleasure. A lot of Catholics today might think, wait a minute, we're not allowed to seek pleasure. That's a bad thing. Now, obviously, during Lent, we should diminish some of that seeking of pleasure. But it's not that pleasure is a bad thing. It seems like Thomas, he hits that mean that gets it just right. Like, I've had a lot of discussions with people about the virtue of obedience. Because I'm convinced that in today's church that there's a misunderstanding of that virtue, that people think that means a subservience to like almost say you obey no matter what if it's a church figure who says it. But if reading St. Thomas, he makes it very clear, no, the only one that we obey unconditionally is God. There's literally not one human being on earth that we are required to obey unconditionally. And, you know, he gives the balance of like, they have to have a sphere of authority over us, over whatever it is they're commanding. They have to actually be our superior. They can't, it's not just simply they can't command sin. We all know that one, but it's more than that. And I just felt like when you read that, you're like, oh, wow, this is putting all the pieces together. It's not this extreme idea, not this Protestant disobedience that, you know, led to Protestantism, but it's also not this kind of weird treat the Pope as like a cult leader. It's this median. I think that I feel like Aquinas can really help us figure out a lot of the crisis in the church by getting that medium right there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And as you know, he has a whole part in the Summa under fraternal correction where he talks about being able to, there is a time and place where one can correct and should, not just can, but should correct prelates if they're in serious sin. Now, we have to also understand our own tendency towards being arrogant and self-righteous and all that. It's sort of like anger. It's like, well, yeah, I guess you can be angry without sinning, but look at you, you're an idiot. And every time you've done that, you've usually sinned. So just go really easy with that. You know, I think similarly when it comes to the kind of maybe direct correcting of prelates, but it's still something Aquinas says that we shouldn't, not just can, but should do in certain instances.
Right, because there's this idea that Lumen Gentium 25 makes it sound like we're not ever allowed to disagree with what the Pope or church leaders. It basically is the passage, for those who aren't aware, it's a passage that talks about how we need to give submission of mind, religious submission of mind and will to the Pope. And it's taken to mean that we never can correct him or anything. But I think you're right that the balance there, the Aquinas balance probably is, if we're just doing it, we're angry or whatever, or just like lashing out, that's not really appropriate either. To do it that way. And I think it's a matter of also, again, I think it comes back to what we were saying before about these concentric circles. If your bishop is doing something that you believe is, after prayer and thinking about it, is wrong, then yes, you should speak out against him. But are you really required to say something that some bishop in Ireland, for example, is doing wrong? Right. Is that really something you need to like spend your emotional energy on? But maybe your own bishop, and obviously the Pope applies to everybody. But I think that's probably healthy as well when we're thinking about criticizing clerics. And I know I fall into that myself. I have a tendency when I see something bad somewhere, like I want to tweet about it, and I got to hold back on that.
Yeah, maybe not. It's really hard to know, isn't it? I mean, these are confusing times, and I really am trying to give as much leeway to people as I can, precisely because we're in outrageously confusing times. I think I love traditions. I love the tradition of the church. I love my traditional brethren. Sometimes I think maybe I'm a trad. I don't know what I am. I try just to love Jesus and be obedient to the church's teachings. And I love the traditions. I try to implement them in my family. But certainly criticisms can be leveled of people who are leaning one way or the other in any regard. And maybe there's this desire to kind of make everything unduly black and white in every possible regard in order to feel sort of safe and secure in a way that maybe is artificial. I don't know. I actually do think that's true. We're always going to be dealing with some amount of chaos and uncertainty, even if it, as you just said, as it pertains to like what you should be tweeting and talking about. I mean, like, I don't know, like those things that an individual bishop says in Ireland do cause scandal, perhaps. Like someone's going to be saying like, that's wrong. So I don't know. It's one of those things that it's like, I wish there was an exact rule book.
Right.
Here's exactly what you should do today and nothing else. But there isn't that. There's prudence, which we have to pray for and develop.
Yeah. I try to give a lot of leeway to Catholics that at least seem to be trying to figure things out. And they're trying to determine, is this the right, you know, they're trying to live their faith, and it's clear they're trying to follow the tradition, stuff like that. So, you know, like you said, a good example, the ones you mentioned before, like Taylor Marshall and Church Militant, it's like, yeah, do I disagree with some of the things they say and do? Yeah. But do I think they're both trying essentially to make some sense out of the chaos in the church and try to make things better? Yeah, I do. I actually think they both, in both instances, they are. And that applies to a lot of people. When people criticize somebody like Scott Hahn for not speaking out about this stuff publicly, I'm like, wait a second. He's doing what his work is doing, is bringing lots of people in, helping a lot of people grow in their faith. We're on the same team. But then I would draw a line at somebody like a Father James Martin. No, I think he's an enemy. and so I'm not going to necessarily be like, oh, well, he's just trying his best. Like, no, I actually think he's a wolf in shepherd, you know, in a priest clothing. So I do think there's lines there. And I do think even that line I'm drawing, and maybe I'm wrong about it. I don't know, but it just seems like from what
The other thing too is like, surely not every single Catholic with any kind of platform is all meant to be pointing the finger at the church crisis in the Vatican at all times.
Right.
First of all, every Catholic, if they're on social media, has a platform. It's not like 20, 30 years ago when only a select few did. Every single Catholic who's online has a platform. And surely we're not saying that every single one of them ought to be continually pointing to what Pope Francis may or may not have just said. You know, people are called to different things, and that's what we're
doing. Right. I think we're going to wrap this up here. I just want to, maybe if you could say, okay, so the happy, what's the book called? Be Happy? Or
How to Be Happy.
How to Be Happy.
Aquinas, the Secret to a Good Life.
So definitely I want to recommend that to people. Your book about the Does God Exist? Socratic Dialogue with Five Ways of Saint of Thomas Aquinas. Your podcast, Pints with Aquinas. I was told, it's funny, I shouldn't say this, but I'll just say somebody who is close to my family, I'll put it that way. He was telling me how he listens to my podcast. He likes, he goes, but my favorite is Matt Fratz. That's the best one because it's just great. And I think I think you do have an excellent podcast. I think it's great because it allows people to kind of just talk and have a conversation. I'm tempted to call you the Catholic Joe Rogan, but is that a good thing or bad thing? I don't know. Because like Joe Rogan, the great thing about him is just simply that he sits down and he lets people talk. He lets them, you know, talk about, and he brings things up.
No, I
do something similar.
I fully and unapologetically stole his format. I mean, they said the good borrow the great steal. I fully intended to steal because I just love
the format. Yeah, and I just think the fact that he has like the ability, he has people there with him in person. Like what we're doing here is second best. It's not as good as being in person because you can't have as full and as deep of a conversation online as you can in person. But anyway, so I recommend people, if you don't already, you probably already do, but if you don't already follow Matt's podcast, please do that. Is there any final words you want to say to help people, advice you want to give Catholics who are trying to figure out their way in this kind of chaotic world?
No, not really. You know, one guy who I would just do a shout out for, who I think is doing a really good job of threading the needle, is Ralph Martin. I don't know what you think.
Ralph is great. He's great. I love Ralph.
He's going to be in the studio tomorrow, actually. So we'll be live tomorrow. Well, whenever this airs, obviously. I just have great love for him. Like, he's a man who loves Jesus Christ. And whenever I'm with him or whenever I read him, I want to be holy, repent of my sin, and read the Bible more. And I think if you're around somebody or you're listening to somebody and that's your reaction, you should keep listening to that individual. So I would recommend his work and just beg the prayers of those listening. That sounds kind of trite, but you don't have to pray for me, but if you would, maybe just offer a Hail Mary, one Hail Mary, just for me and my family and the work of clients. I'd appreciate that.
Yeah, great, great stuff. I had Ralph on last year, and he's great because he breaks all the stereotypes of, you know, he's a charismatic, but
I love it.
People call him a traditionalist because of his views on salvation and stuff like that, but it's all... He loves Jesus is what I say. And he loves the Catholic Church. And like you said, when you talk to him, you do feel like, I want to be a better Catholic. And that's great. So, okay. Thanks a lot, Matt. I really appreciate you being on. And thanks everybody for watching or listening. Until next time, everybody, God love you.